This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Steak and Shake is one of Bloomington Normal's most famous exports, but now it's in financial trouble.
It's heartbreaking, quite honestly. You know, I dedicated over 30 years of my career to help build that company and help build relationships.
You'll hear from former Steak and Shake District Manager Greg Snodgrass and others about the restaurant chain's uncertain future. Also, a full recap of a busy end to the spring session in Springfield. And correspondent Brianna Grove files a dispatch from a truly adorable cat show competition in Bloomington. All that after a GLT news update. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Chain restaurants love moving into Bloomington Normal, but Steak and Shake was that rare unicorn, the chain restaurant that Bloomington Normal sent out into the world. But 85 years after its founding in Normal, Steak and Shake is in trouble. Our story begins with Greg Snodgrass, who started at Steak and Shake as a busboy in 1979 in Bloomington Normal. His career grew as the company did, and other local staff would travel the country to help open new locations and train staff on the Steak and Shake culture, quality service, and cleanliness.
We had little meetings 15 minutes before our shift started, and we'd have uniform inspections and the whole nine yards. It was really something that we all took pride in.
It was fun. But by 2008, it wasn't fun anymore. Snodgrass was a district manager then, overseeing nine locations between Bloomington and Paducah, Kentucky. Snodgrass says the new owner, Big Laurie Holdings, was cutting wages and benefits, part of a recession-era discounting survival plan. So Snodgrass left. Today, those changes have brought Steak and Shake to the brink. Sales have sunk, dozens of locations have closed, employee lawsuits have piled up, and some are speculating that a major contraction, or worse, is near.
It's heartbreaking, quite honestly. You know, I dedicated over 30 years of my career to help build that company and help build relationships. And when you walk into the restaurants and the service isn't good and the cleanliness isn't there, the quality of the food is still there. But if you don't have the other two things, it really isn't Steak and Shake anymore to me.
Steak and Shake is one of Bloomington Normal's most famous exports, right up there with State Farm and Beer Nuts. Gus and Edith Belt opened the first location at Main Street and Virginia Avenue in Normal in 1934. Their family sold the company in 1969, and it's changed hands many times since then. Today, Steak and Shake has 580 locations and is based in Indianapolis and owned by Texas-based Big Laurie Holdings. Bill Kemp with the McLean County Museum of History says another locally grown company that followed a similar path was Eureka Williams, which became Electrolux and then moved away.
Bloomington Normal, given kind of its vibrancy throughout its history, has produced corporations or brand names that are known throughout the country, sometimes in some cases the world, and some of those still have local ties and some do not.
There are a few remnants of the Steak and Shake legacy that have survived here. The chain still has four restaurants in town. The original one on Main Street, though, is now a Monocle's. Another old location is now Keller's Iron Skillet. Kemp says Gus and Edith Belt built Steak and Shake's brand on the steak burger.
Gus Belt was known to make quite a show of that. He would actually wheel in a barrel in some of the early stores full of sirloins or T-bones, and then that would be ground right on site so customers could see what was going into their steak burgers.
Cleanliness was also a selling point. Their slogan was, "In sight, it must be right."
The idea was if you could see the food being made, so the grill cooks were out there in the open through glass windows, and originally the meat was ground on site, that was an indication that things were on the up and up there.
But that was a long time ago. Today, the company is owned by Sardar Big Laurie, a young investor who emigrated to the U.S. from Iran. He took over Steak and Shake in 2008 amid the Great Recession. He discounted relentlessly, famously offering meals under $4, and it worked. Sales soared.
For 7 years, he seemingly could do no wrong.
That's Greg Andrews, who's covered the company extensively as editor of the Indianapolis Business Journal.
That worked and worked and worked, and then about 2016, it stopped working, and the company has continued to really slide since then.
Critics say the customer experience slipped, and so did the service. All that discounting comes at a cost. Steak and Shake also faced a new challenge from growing fast casual chains like Chipotle, Panera, and Jason's Deli. Younger consumers were willing to pay more, and the race to the bottom for value was ending. That's according to Danny Klein, who covers Steak and Shake for the QSR Food Trade magazine.
So you're either playing on one side of convenience, or you're, you know, going kind of higher end with some of these upscale fast casuals or sit-down chains or fine dining, you know, people that are taking share like that. So Steak and Shake's case, they're sort of now at a point where they're not really, you know, they're not really offering either of those.
Owner Sardar Biglari is a mysterious figure who does not do media interviews. He didn't respond to requests for comment from GLT. His only public comments typically come in his annual shareholder letters. In his 2019 letter, Biglari conceded that they, quote, erroneously stayed with equipment and kitchen design that was ill-suited for volume production, and that the effect was high-cost, labor-intensive, slow service. He says they failed customers by not being fast and friendly. They paid the price for that. Steak and Shake's revenue last year declined 3.5%, what Biglari himself called a significant disappointment. During the first quarter of 2019, same-store sales fell almost 8%, the 10th straight quarterly decline, even as other similar restaurants saw growth. David Henkes is with Technomic, a research and consulting firm for the restaurant industry.
I mean, they're playing smack dab in a very competitive set from big national players, right, that have huge reach and big marketing dollars, and, you know, all the way down to small local or, you know, regional chains or even, you know, independent burger places.
Henkes says Steak and Shake isn't doing much to differentiate itself.
Not that it's, you know, the death knell for the chain, but it's certainly a challenge for them to grow out of that without doing something different.
And something different is an ambitious strategy that Biglari laid out earlier this year. He wants to franchise off all 400 company-owned restaurants. Franchisees will only have to put up about $10,000. It's a bargain in the industry. And they'll pay 15% of sales and 50% of profits back to Steak and Shake. And franchisees can only own one restaurant. That's similar to the Chick-fil-A model, geared toward hands-on franchise ownership. Experts tell GLT that retroactively turning a restaurant chain into an all-franchise model is a bit unusual, and to prepare for it, Steak and Shake has temporarily closed dozens of stores that will theoretically be franchised, including some in Peoria. But when a restaurant temporarily closes, restaurant journalist Danny Klein says they tend not to reopen.
I haven't seen anybody offer up a franchise for $10,000 in the time that I've been here. And the whole and everything they're doing right now is pretty uncommon. So I guess we don't really know how it's going to turn out.
Steak and Shake also faces a big challenge in court. Nearly 1,500 Steak and Shake managers across the country have sued the company, claiming they were improperly classified as salary employees and not compensated for the overtime they worked. Around 280 managers from the St. Louis area were just awarded $7.5 million in the first of two lawsuits. The second pending lawsuit has just under 1,200 plaintiffs, including around 400 from Illinois. That's according to their attorney, Brendan Donnellan of Kansas City, Missouri. Donnellan says these managers were making only $32,000 to $40,000 a year and were doing much of the same work as lower-level hourly employees.
So their job was to just plug in the holes each and every shift. And I think it's pretty easy to figure out that if you're not having to pay the hourly people overtime to do all this work or to have extra hourly people there, and you're paying one person just a set dollar amount to work 70 hours a week, it's a big cost-cutting and savings measure for a company.
Steak and Shake said each case is without merit and it intends to defend these cases vigorously. However, Donnellan says the company is set for settlement talks with plaintiffs from both cases in early June. So does this all add up to the end for Steak and Shake? Greg Andrews, who covers the company from Indianapolis, says Steak and Shake has about $184 million in debt that it's supposed to pay off in March of 2021.
It's losing a lot of money at the moment, so it really doesn't have the ability to pay that off. If it starts to turn itself around, then lenders would probably give it a lot more breathing room. But if it's in a tailspin, which is what it really is in today, that debt could force Steak and Shake into bankruptcy.
A significant retraction or fewer locations may be more likely. Danny Klein says it's not uncommon today to see restaurant chains retract pretty dramatically. Applebee's is one recent example.
I think a chain of this type of scale and, you know, guest affinity and history, and the fact that they were on a really good run there for, you know, a pretty good period of time, I would be surprised to see them go bankrupt. But I would also say that it's definitely nothing is ever impossible in this industry. I mean, restaurants are such a fluctuating kind of business.
Brendan Donnellan, the attorney who represents the managers, says it's hard to speculate about the company's financial health because Steak and Shake is just one part of the Biglari Holdings portfolio. Biglari also owns Maxim Magazine and the Western Sizzlin' restaurant chain, among other investments.
It's hard for me to look at that and decipher exactly which of that are Steak and Shake assets and Steak and Shake liabilities, things along those lines. So it's always a concern in all of my cases, but it's hard for me to speculate here whether or not it's going to have a big impact on our verdict and on our second lawsuit.
Greg Snodgrass, the busboy who became a district manager, gave the company another chance himself. He returned from 2010 to 2013, but it wasn't enjoyable anymore. He says the family-friendly atmosphere was gone. He left again.
Just keeps piling on. I don't know. There's some talk that it may even just fold up and go away, which I hope doesn't happen.
You can see historic photos of Steak and Shake, courtesy of the McLean County Museum of History, at WGLT.org. We'll have a link to their Steak and Shake collection. I'm Ryan Denham, and this is Sound Ideas. Coming up, we'll recap a busy and productive weekend in Springfield. But first, 3 days after he was appointed chair of Illinois Wesleyan University's Board of Trustees, Timothy Zerlong received a major assignment: find a new president. Eric Jensen has announced his resignation after less than 4 years on the job. Zerlong tells GLT's Eric Stock what the university is looking for in a new leader.
Certainly, we're looking for someone with a track record of leadership in academics, and certainly someone that can be a thoughtful agent of continuing change, continuing to drive growth for the university, and that takes on many elements. We will need to be building on our strengths. We have some wonderful educational offerings today that I think allow us to be that distinctive institution. Our nursing program would be a terrific example of that. We want to build on that and build on that strength, and at the same time have more and different kind of compelling offerings. One avenue that we intend to invest in going forward are educational opportunities that will focus on technology and entrepreneurship, data analytics, elements that are clearly in the forefront of what's changing in the world, regardless of what type of career pathway one might consider.
What level of concern would you have given the financial state that universities are going through at the public and private levels? And both you and President Jensen have alluded to this, that it is more difficult, and you're going to want a pretty long-term commitment from the next person to see through this long arc of a transition. So how do you make that work?
Well, I think, first of all, it's finding the right person. But, you know, I view where the financial challenges are big, the opportunities likewise are big. We have a strong, supportive alumni network that contributes to the university. We have certainly the ability to invest in new programs as we have done and will continue to do. And at the same time, it requires a president that can be fiscally responsible and find ways of more efficiently delivering certain curriculum offerings at the same time as we invest and grow. It's a you know, very challenging balancing act to make that dollar, an educational dollar, go as far as we can. And, you know, I'm pretty optimistic about Wesleyan's ability to navigate that going forward.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Eric Stock with Timothy Zerlong, the chair of the Illinois Wesleyan Board of Trustees. The university is looking for a new president, as Eric Jensen has announced his retirement. And as you look ahead to a change in leadership and the ongoing need for change to adapt, what is the most essential to keeping the university on track and meeting its goals?
When we look at Illinois Wesleyan, I think we have so many strengths and so many unique qualities as a university. I could not be more optimistic about our future. When you go through a change in leadership, that obviously has some people defaulting to questions or concerns, and I don't believe there should be any. I am 110% confident that our future is bright, and we will be every bit as distinctive as a university 5 years from today as we are today, and that is in part because of the outstanding caliber of faculty and staff we have at Illinois Wesleyan. We are so fortunate with the people that we have on board. And when you speak to the specific time of transition or change, one of the things that buoys my confidence the most is that our leaders, the vice presidents that run the various functional areas of the university, are terrific. And they are on point in bringing the university along. They're making great progress. And we have, as a board, the highest confidence in that group.
Do you have a time frame for when you would like to have somebody in the permanent seat?
Well, I think, you know, my understanding of the search process, and we have formed, we are just right now forming a search committee, and so we do some homework on that process. I think it is likely to do a search right. It takes, you know, nearly a year from today to identify that next candidate. So that's our expectation. Certainly, we are very confident and fully expect to have that new long-term president on board by the midsummer of 2020. And it's also my expectation that we have an interim president identified and on board in early August of this year. And I'm highly confident that we will achieve that without any difficulty.
That's Timothy Zerlong, chair of the Illinois Wesleyan University Board of Trustees, with GLT's Eric Stock. Jensen's predecessor, Dick Wilson, will serve as acting president until Wesleyan names an interim leader later this summer. This is Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from the Economic Development Council, presenting BN by the Numbers Thursday, June 27th at ISU's Alumni Center. It's an update on local economic progress in McLean County. Tickets are available by emailing Becky at bnbiz.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. The Illinois General Assembly finally finished its annual legislative session this weekend, with lawmakers approving item after item on Governor J.B. Pritzker's agenda. Observers and participants are calling it one of the most significant sessions in living memory. IPR State House editor Brian Mackey has been in the Capitol for all of it and filed this report.
By the time the Illinois Senate finished its business late Sunday afternoon, the General Assembly had voted to legalize marijuana, pass a $45 billion infrastructure plan, expand gambling, legalize sports betting, pass a state budget, begin the process of amending the income tax article in the state constitution, and expand access to abortion. It had been a long, contentious week after a long month and a long session. The night before, when the House held its final votes, Republican leader Jim Durkin addressed his closing remarks to the freshman lawmakers.
We've had some moments where you've heard a lot of things and a lot of people have said some tough stuff on the floor. Did you hear that today? Did you notice the tenor of the debate and also the feeling that I had in this chamber today? It was pretty darn good. Because you know why? Because we worked it out. We worked out this very difficult day.
Moments later, House Speaker Michael Madigan was triumphant.
This has been an extraordinarily productive session of the General Assembly. Simply historic.
But this is hindsight, and just the day before, a cooperative outcome was far from certain. See, Democrats spent the week flexing their supermajority, ramming legislation through on party-line votes. From the Republican perspective, these ideas fell on a range from wrongheaded, like the graduated income tax constitutional amendment, to repugnant, like the legislation intended to keep abortion legal should Roe v. Wade be overturned. This did not sit well with Republicans, and by Friday, which was scheduled to be the last day of session, the whole thing seemed to be coming apart. Rounds of diplomacy ensued, with people crisscrossing the Capitol through out-of-the-way stairwells.
I haven't been in this stairway in years.
Durkin met with Pritzker. Senate President John Cullerton met with Durkin. Durkin was back in the governor's office, and Pritzker even attended a private meeting of the Senate Republican caucus. By the end of the night, the House was passing a budget with support from Democrats and Republicans. Once again, Republican leader Durkin.
Our caucus will work with the majority party on any issue, and we will respect your priorities as long as you respect our priorities.
Those priorities included a series of business-friendly additions to the final deal, like an extension of the research and development tax credit and the creation of a new tax credit intended to lure data centers to Illinois. There was a little more back and forth, but by Friday evening, the die was cast, and the plan was on track through the weekend. And that brings us back to where we started, the floor of the Senate late Sunday afternoon after the work of session was over. Pritzker is here, being swarmed by lawmakers seeking photos. Cullerton thanked Pritzker and praised his leadership. Later, he was asked why Pritzker had been able to pass so much of his agenda.
Yeah, well, start with a super-duper majority in both chambers. That kind of helps. The other governors don't have as much process. But he just really got along. He's just really a nice guy, and that helps. And keep in mind, he was new. He had never done this before, so he did a great job.
At a news conference that evening, Pritzker seemed to agree.
Together, we just accomplished one of the most ambitious and consequential legislative sessions in this state's history.
All that said, there are still questions about what came out of session. Like, what will legal marijuana do to the face of Illinois? And what about all that new gambling? Is the budget really balanced? And why, after the shooting rampage in Aurora, did lawmakers fail to pass a bill on guns? But as far as Democrats and a fair number of Republicans are concerned, those questions can wait for another day. For now, they're basking in the satisfaction that comes from a thoroughly checked-off to-do list. I'm Brian Mackey.
Staying in Springfield, the Illinois Politics Roundtable concentrates on one of Governor Pritzker's top wants. Sean Crawford moderates the panel with Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield, IPR Statehouse editor Brian Mackey, who you just heard from, and Amanda Vinicky of WTTW in Chicago. Governor Pritzker got passage of a constitutional amendment asking voters to change from a flat tax to a graduated income tax. Mackey says it'll be on the ballot statewide next fall.
Yeah, what's at stake is about $3.5 billion, depending on whom you ask, to do what Governor Pritzker says is necessary to fix some of the longstanding structural deficits in this state. There have been a lot of proposals over the years of redoing the state's taxing system, whether that be imposing service taxes, moving away from sales taxes on goods and products and moving to services. But one of those other calls we've heard a lot about is moving away from our flat tax to a graduated tax. And that is what lawmakers put on the ballot. This is a constitutional amendment because the flat tax is ensconced in the Illinois Constitution, has been since 1970. And this would go before the voters. Voters will have the final say. It has to be 60% approval when this question is on the ballot in November 2020, or I think it's a majority of the people voting in the election if they vote in favor of this, even if it doesn't clear 60% on that particular question, then it would be approved.
Amanda, this was Governor Pritzker, maybe I would say near the top of his agenda going into this session, and it's a win for him. I think there's no other way to look at that, just to get it on the ballot.
It's a huge win for him, considering that, as Brian noted, overhauling Illinois' tax structure has been something that's been talked about for a long time. Other governors have attempted to do. Looking back to the last Democratic governor, Pat Quinn, the graduated income tax was something that he, too, embraced and wanted. I'm not sure how much political capital Quinn had to really throw at that. And unlike J.B. Pritzker, of course, Quinn, nor really any of the previous governors, including Bruce Rauner, had enough of the actual capital and money to put behind a campaign pledge, bringing it to fruition like this. It is certainly significant that the legislature voted to put this on the 2020 ballot, but ooh, this is nowhere near the end of it, because, of course, leading up to that point in time, you're going to surely see a huge public battle waged to voters. Already that is the case, where you're having constantly, we're getting press releases, commercials on the radio, on TV, on both sides, business entities trying to fight against this. And then Pritzker has said that he won't say how much money he's putting behind a group called Think Big, sort of a play on his Think Big pledge during when he was running for governor. But he is putting his own money behind trying to actually get voters to ratify that amendment. So it is central in so many reasons. I will say, however, that the tax discussion isn't done, because even in order to get Democrats on board, and interestingly, I would point out that while there had been some speculation, I mean, frankly, I thought, yes, Pritzker is going to get his way. It's going to get on the ballot. How many Democrats will back it, we don't know. Really, there was just one in the House that didn't vote for it, and we still don't really have a good answer as to why. All Democrats backed the constitutional amendment, save for one representative, Andre Tappetti, who didn't vote at all, left the floor, and we're not sure what that really is all about. Regardless, in order to get some of those Democrats on board, Pritzker, immediately following the vote, had a press conference with them announcing yet another task force, this time looking at property taxes. There's still a lot of consternation as to Illinois' overall tax structure and how to deal with that. Those questions about taxing services, the sales tax on services, as the economy changes and is a more modernized and service-based than goods-based. That's not part of this.
And another part of it, too, had to do with property taxes, which I thought was interesting. There was legislation that came through the House, and it's now pending in the Senate, to create an Illinois property tax relief fund that would say a certain amount of money from the new revenues generated by the graduated income tax would be put into this fund, and each tax year the comptroller, based on the total number of homestead exemptions that are on file with assessment officials across the state, would divide up equally among those assessments the amount of money in this tax relief fund. So you might be getting $200, $250 back as part of, I guess, a way to kind of ease the pain of the tax, higher taxes that you might have to pay. Although the way the rates are structured now, only people at the very, very top end of the income scale would wind up paying more.
Go ahead, Brian. I think you wanted to get in there.
Well, I was just going to comment on, you know, Amanda talked about the task force, which is sort of the last refuge of when you have an intractable political issue and you either don't know how to solve it or you know how but don't have the political will to solve it. Create a task force so you can put off the tough decisions for another day.
That's Brian Mackey, State House editor for IPR, along with Amanda Vinicky of WTTW in Chicago, Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield, and moderator Sean Crawford. As you just heard, the General Assembly has made significant changes to the state. We thought we'd listen back to some of the voices that made news in the last week of the 2019 legislative session.
It's been a long year. We've had a lot of emotions that have gone on in this chamber.
This is an opportunity to fix the problems of Illinois and begin reestablishing the essential services that government is supposed to deliver.
Here we are debating a constitutional amendment to hike taxes when WalletHub says Illinois' tax burden is the highest in the nation.
These definitions seem overly broad, and I am certain that most doctors, if their incentive is to perform an abortion, would be able to find some kind of loophole here to figure that out.
I am disgusted by the propaganda that is out there suggesting that any woman late in her pregnancy, or even after giving birth, as I've heard from some, and then decide, I just don't want this child, and simply end its life.
If we are going to do this, we must ensure that Black and brown communities that have been divested in, that have been locked up and have been castigated to the side, have to be central to this policy, and that is what we have in this bill.
We can disagree, Mr. President, on tax policy and environmental policy, but we can all get on the same page, I hope, that what we don't want to do at this time and place is to do something that will make it more likely that more of our citizenry will at some point develop mental illness.
It's amazing what we can do around here in just a few hours if people are willing to work together. And we just started doing that. So I feel we're on a good path, and I'm pleased to put my vote on the board tonight, and let's get our work done by tomorrow.
We know that as we continue to work collaboratively, if that is what we indeed want to do, when we work collaboratively, there are a lot of things that we can indeed get done.
And so we have a situation where many of our buildings, our state buildings, are in a state of poor repair that needs to be remedied.
Now, I know it's difficult to pay for that infrastructure, but anybody who's traveled our roads knows that we've been shortchanging that investment for years. Tonight, we have a very difficult vote, but a necessary vote, because if our infrastructure crumbles, our rural economy crumbles with it.
It's backed by business, it's backed by labor, and it's backed by contractors as well as transit officials.
We're authorizing six casinos: Chicago, Waukegan, South Suburbs, Williamson County, or Walker's Bluff as known, Rockford, and Danville.
I've only been doing this for 20 years trying to get this done, and it's a little emotional. And I have to say, this has been a job creation bill from day one. If we were bringing in six new manufacturers to town, everybody would be on board. Well, guess what? We're putting six types of manufacturing on board. They're going to generate money for the state. They're going to generate employees. They're going to generate economic development, not only in those communities, but in the state of Illinois.
So, Mr. Governor, do you see what a difference it makes to have somebody new in the governor's office? This has been an extraordinarily productive session of the General Assembly. Simply historic.
Illinois is back. Illinois is open for business. This is a place that stands up for working families. I mean, our best days are ahead of us.
IPR's Mary Hansen produced that feature. This is Sound Ideas.
My name is Christopher Gallwitzer. I own and operate Night Shop in downtown Bloomington.
And Night Shop is a new GLT underwriter.
We're reaching people who are looking outside of the box for music, people that are educated and know something about conscious eating. GLT is an accessible station with strong followers and open-minded followers. To me, it's kind of a no-brainer.
Learn more about partnering with GLT at wglt.org/corporate-support.
Support for GLT comes from Monkey Duck Marina, just a little beyond normal on Lake Bloomington, offering pontoon, bass boat, canoe, and kayak rentals for sport, leisure, or fishing. Services include concessions, bait, and propane. Details at monkeyduckmarina.com. This is 89.1 GLT and wglt.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. It's been over a decade since the Cat Fanciers Association last held a cat show in Bloomington. GLT correspondent Brianna Groh paid the furry contestants and their owners a visit Saturday at the Interstate Center in Bloomington.
Vicki Edwards has traveled over 800 miles from Arlington, Texas to show her 18-month-old Maine Coon Brutus at the Cat Fanciers Association All-Breed Cat Show at the Interstate Center in Bloomington Saturday. After he took a regional win last year and defeated 200 cats to become a grand champion before that, Edwards has high hopes for what Brutus can accomplish this year.
We hope maybe he might make a national win this year. We'll see. We'll see if he can do that. He has a brother and two sisters that have, so we hope he follows in the family footsteps and does that.
Edwards says at 19 pounds and counting, Brutus, like other Maine Coons, is truly a gentle giant.
So affectionate and loving. It would be hard not to love a Maine Coon, I think. You know, they're extroverts. They just love everybody, you know, but they're pretty laid back, though.
The pair compete with 160 other cats and 30 different breeds in the regional show. While Edwards and other owners and breeders spend plenty of time and money on showing cats, there's no prize money to take home. The Cat Fanciers Association is a 501c4 not-for-profit, and all proceeds from the event will be used to cover expenses, with any remaining money donated to the Humane Society of Central Illinois. Instead, the owners and breeders showing at competitions are in it for the love of people, and of course, cats. Roger Brown used to show dogs before he and his wife attended a cat show where they first laid eyes on the wild-looking Ossicat.
We just fell in love with it, little spotted cats, and we decided to get some and show them.
On Saturday, he's brought three Ossicats with him from Elkhorn, Nebraska, including newcomer Tina and one-time national winner Lord Max.
It's a little better at a cat show because each ring is like a separate show. So this show has eight rings. It's like you have eight chances to win instead of one.
Annette Wilson has been judging cat shows since 1987. But on Saturday, she's attending as an owner. She explains the judges are looking for how well each cat fits the association's standard for their breed.
So if I were judging, say, a Maine Coon, I'd be judging that particular exhibit against the standard of perfection. And it's divided into conformation or type and structure and coat and color. And different points are allotted depending on what's weighted more.
The cat that best meets the standard wins the breed. Final winners are decided in a similar way.
Is this Maine Coon meet the Maine Coon standard better than this Persian meets the Persian standard?
Wilson says it took a lot of time and effort to become a judge, but it's all worth it to be able to handle scores of cats at each competition.
Oh, I get to pet all the cats when I'm at a show, when I'm judging, and I still breed and show. So I get to see both sides of the table. And I was judging in Hong Kong. So I get to travel the world and meet cat fanciers all over the world, and that really makes it worthwhile.
And despite the stereotype that cats and their owners keep to themselves, Wilson says showing is
definitely a social hobby. When you start doing it, even if your cat doesn't win, you know, if you meet some friends for dinner and share a bottle of wine or something, you had a good weekend. And the more you do it, the more you're basically socializing across the country or in your region with people with a common interest. And of course, we can talk about cats all day long, so that makes it fun.
The shows are also a draw for cat lovers of all ages. Bloomington residents Rachel Carpenter and 7-year-old daughter Elida Carpenter included the show in their girls' weekend plans.
Elida is passionate about cats, so we figured today would be a great day to come and explore the cats, learn all about the different species. She can tell me so much more than I even know. She loves to read the books about cats, and so we figured we've only seen some pictures of some of these breeds. We'd really like to see the real thing.
Elida is on the lookout for a particular breed.
Well, one of my favorite breeds of cat is the Bengal cat, because they look really nice.
Yeah, and are those the ones with spots?
They usually have, like, spots, and some of them also have stripes.
Meanwhile, retirees Diane and Steve Kaz have never been to a cat show before.
I watched dog shows on TV and thought, well, we like cats. Let's go to the show.
Yeah.
Is it what you expected?
And more. I am amazed at how close up you can come. Some people actually let you talk and pet their cat, and they're very open about it. I'm amazed at how calm the animals are.
Right?
Yeah.
But it's fun. They're beautiful cats. We have never seen so many varieties. That's what made it the most interesting.
So it's a big education for you?
It has been.
It has been. Quite the education on cats. I think I know
it
more about cats than I ever did.
To get a cat.
I know.
And if you were to meet them, you might just want one too. I'm Brianna Groh.
Man, I'm glad that she fits some sound of a cat meowing in there. This year's worldwide winners will be decided in October at the Cat Fanciers Association International Cat Show in Cleveland, Ohio. This is Sound Ideas. The vocalist and lyricist for the Bloomington-based punk rock outfit Poster Children says his one-man band, Thoughts Detecting Machines, allows him to flesh out ideas not necessarily a fit for Poster Children. Rick Valentin performs as Thoughts Detecting Machines this Thursday at Night Shop. He tells GLT's John Norton the electronic music he makes at home has bass elements similar to Poster Children.
Even in Poster Children, a lot of our music is kind of a single riff played over and over again. So in the same way, when I work with Thoughts Detecting Machines stuff, it's really about building up something. So I'll have one little loop or riff, and then I just layer. And so it's really about layering and just stacking and stacking and stacking, and then pulling bits and pieces out of that giant stack of bits and pieces.
How does that technically work?
Specifically, like something like Oscar F, it's this little sort of beatbox, old Yamaha band in a box type of thing where you could have little drum patterns and synth patterns and presets, and it's just kind of like building it up. If you've ever seen video of Kraftwerk playing Pocket Calculator, they do their normal synthesizer act, but then they have these little tiny devices and they play the whole song on just little tiny handheld devices. And so originally a song like Oscar F came from just having this little tiny beatbox and then being able to feed a guitar through it and kind of do everything with a little tiny box.
So we're playing Oscar F right now. Can I take a guess? Oscar F?
Mm-hmm.
Fischinger?
Yeah, wow, that's great.
Knowing you as I do, that would make total sense.
Oscar Fischinger was a animator, and he's sort of the biggest obvious influence. Well, this is, I guess maybe this is an obscure influence too, but if Fantasia, where you see the kind of abstract animations tied to music. So he was an early animator that did musical animations, so converted sound into visuals in an abstract, moving way, using paper cutouts and everything like that.
Thoughts Detecting Machines, where does the name come from?
Oh, it was an early kind of web conspiracy theory. There was a email or a blog post that sort of went around the internet in the very early days, a person talking about how I think the CIA, or maybe it was North Korea, was building a thoughts detecting machine and how it was tapping into people's thoughts. And it was a very weird kind of strange conspiracy theory. And, okay. And I liked the, it was in broken English, and the idea of thoughts detecting machine, I liked how strange that phrase sounded.
So let's go to the song. Is it called Interferon? Am I pronouncing that right? Okay. As we're playing the song, what does Thoughts Detecting Machine, what does that allow you to do creatively that maybe you can't do with Poster Children?
It allows me to write bass parts, drum parts. The thing about Poster Children is it's collaborative. It may seem like a traditional band, but the reality is that I don't write the music in Poster Children. We write it collectively, so I have a hand in it. And then I act more like a director because I do write the lyrics and the melody, and so I'm able to sculpt the music in Poster Children. But if I come up with ideas that aren't Poster Children-y and also aren't, you know, vocal or guitar based, this is kind of an outlet for that.
Okay. So far, both these songs have been instrumentals. Let's go to the song Mad, Mad, Madness World.
It's really about men, I guess, and where they're at right now, and singing to women and basically just saying, hey, you know, don't let yourself be defined by these dysfunctional people, right? Which are men.
Swimming in the river with rocks in your pocket, trying hard to break the surface, but always scraping bottom. It's time to take a deep breath and make the great escape. Stop looking in the mirror and drop that extra weight. You gotta just forget the guys who lie.
The thing is I kind of empathize in a weird way as being kind of a white man. In one way, I'm on the wrong side of this, but I also feel like I've had a lot of problems with men too. And so it's kind of about, hey, don't let yourself be defined by these people. And I think it's a message that's not just gender specific. It is really just kind of like there are these people, predominantly men, because they're in the position of power, that kind of want to define you, and then you feel like you have to define yourself based on their standards.
Do you consider yourself a feminist?
I guess so, as much as a guy like me can be a feminist, a man.
Because women have been asking guys for, especially the last few years with the Me Too movement, but, you know, subtly probably for decades or centuries, to help them with the movement, right?
Yeah, and that's the thing is I don't feel like I'm an aggressive, evil man, and so I I felt like I gave myself a pass, but then I realized it really sunk in lately that I'm a contributor to the problem because I'm passive in a way, or I'll, you know, sort of like cringe when somebody says something awful, but I don't actually say, hey, that's awful.
Yeah. Because women are asking us to do that, right?
Exactly.
They're saying the same as, you know, people of color are asking us to call things out when you don't just let it go.
And I see myself as like a moderator or a peacekeeper a lot of times. And so I'll try to rationalize things, or I'll try to bridge, make, you know, sort of say, oh, well, maybe he didn't mean that, or you should just not worry about it and everything like that. And I'm realizing now that that's problematic, where it's a good impulse to want to sort of moderate and bring people together. But in a situation where somebody's being pushed down or derided in some way, trying to rationalize or make them feel better by saying, oh, don't worry about it, or, oh, maybe that's not what they meant, isn't actually the right approach. It kind of reinforces all these problems.
We're talking with Rick Valentin. You may know him with Poster Children. His most recent release is with Thoughts Detecting Machine. Your wife, Rose, posted a video when you performed at Night Shop last time of how you actually perform this music. You're solo.
Yeah.
You've got a laptop, a guitar, and you've got three monitors.
Initially, it started with me with just the guitar and the laptop, and that was that idea of having just a very small, compact setup as opposed to the big band setup, and you just plug in directly into the club's sound system, right? And then people said, well, I can't see you play guitar because you have this briefcase in front of your guitar. And so I cut out the front of the briefcase and put a screen in there and a camera to point it at my guitar, so then you could see my guitar through the screen. I had already played a show with that camera guitar setup in Bloomington, and I had, well, what else can I do? And I said, well, okay, I can put a camera on my head and my feet. And so if you can see what I'm doing with my feet, you get a little more of a hint about what's going on. It's kind of like a puzzle. And so having those three screens, you get to see my face singing, and you see what vocals I'm putting into the microphone as a loop. And then you get to see how I'm playing the guitar, and then you get to see my feet, how I'm kind of controlling everything.
All right, Rick Valentin, I've mentioned a couple of songs already. How about you? What song would you like to talk about from this album?
I like the song Fugitives, which is the first vocal song on the record. It's about this future I'm thinking about, where people are nostalgic for driving a car themselves and eating and drinking out of, you know, soda cans and bags and sort of disposable things. It's and going to the beach instead of experiencing life virtually.
We drive ourselves to the beach on Saturday to feel the heat of the sun. We forget all the castles we have built. They wash away in the tide.
I like thinking about that idea of kind of future nostalgia, where the things that we kind of take for granted now, you know, like driving a car to a beach, are going to be these strange, nostalgic kind of theme park experiences in the future. It's like, oh, you want to try driving a car? Here, you know, let's go. You know, I guess you can do that right now in Disneyland, right? You can have the little auto fun driving. But, you know, I think people will be doing that as adults. It'll be like, oh, yeah, my grandparents used to drive me places. I'm going to try this out.
Kind of like those Facebook photos where the rotary phone showing is like,
exactly.
Do you know what this was?
And, you know, my 15-year-old son, you know, has a record player and a tape deck now, you know, like was like, oh, you know, just loved the idea of recording on a cassette deck.
Well, speaking of which, you released the album on cassette, on CD, and on vinyl.
All together. You can't.
And it comes in one package.
You can't buy them separately. Yeah.
Why? Why did you force people to do that? What are you trying to say, Rick?
Well, it's...
Is it passive-aggressive?
It is passive-aggressive, but it's a commentary on formats and how everything old is new again. And also, it's part of the frustration as an artist where people want vinyl. They want... Some people want cassette now again, and some people want CD, and some people want streaming. And it's kind of difficult just economically as a musician to do all those formats. But it's also visually, I liked the idea of having these plain white physical media in the package. It was a conceptual thing.
Sha, 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 sha. Sha, 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 sha.
Valentin talking with GLT's John Norton about his one-man band, electronic project, Thoughts Detecting Machines. Thoughts Detecting Machines performs Night Shop in downtown Bloomington Thursday night. Discover other local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. You can find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. WGLT.org is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Eric Stock, Brianna Groh, and all our colleagues at NPR Illinois in Springfield. I'm Brian Denham. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas, so comment on our Facebook page. We're WGLT-FM, or you can follow us on Twitter. We're all at WGLT News, and I'm at Ryan WGLT. Let's hear a bit more from Thoughts Detecting Machines. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.